Okay, we introduced the book of Job last week, and this week we'll get into lesson one, which covers the first three chapters. I will say that you did such a good job with some of your comments last week in the introduction that some of this tonight, at least, will be a review of some of those same comments because we're going to talk some about Job, we're going to talk some about Satan, and again, some of that was introduced last week in that introductory lesson that we had. So let's go ahead and talk some about the character of Job. We certainly learned some things about him in these early chapters, and so we kind of need to revisit some of what we talked about last week. First of all, concerning his character, right there in the very first verse, there was a man in the land of Uz. That man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. That's the comment made about Job by the author of this book, whomever that might have been. But what did God say to Satan about Job? Yeah, no one like him. There in chapter 1 and verse 8, God speaking to Satan. After he said, "Hey, have you considered my servant Job?" He said, "There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil." So those are words from the very mouth of God concerning the character of Job. Let's make sure that we remember the way God described Job, especially when later we begin to hear his friends describe him. Going to be quite a gulf between what God says about Job and what his friends will end up saying. And so, really, even to understand what takes place later on, we need to make sure we see what God says about it. All right, so let's talk a few minutes then about Job's family. We're really not told anything here in the opening of the book, but did he have any brothers and sisters? Yes, he did. We learn about them later on there in chapter 42 and verse 11 after, God had restored his possessions twofold and given him more children and so forth. It says his brothers and sisters came to him as they had before. Now, it would appear from what is said in chapter 19, verses 13 and 14, that during this period of suffering, they did what? They stayed away. Right, they basically abandoned him during that time. And really you can kind of tell that from the way chapter 42 and verse 11 is worded. Was he married? Yeah, we learned some things about his wife here in the opening chapters, right? He was married. We'll talk a little bit more about what his wife said to him here in a few minutes. Over in chapter 19 and verse 17, there's an interesting reference there. Job kind of describing in detail some of his sufferings. He says his breath had become offensive to his wife. Now, I don't know if that means he just had a good case of halitosis or it's just kind of a figurative way of saying, she didn't want to be around him. I'm not sure exactly what is meant there, but we'll notice that later on. And, of course, he had seven sons and three daughters. Of course, we know what happens to them here in the early part of the book. Later on, and I believe we said this last week, what did God bless him with after he had gone through this period of suffering? Same number, right? Same thing later on. But anyway, we'll eventually get to all of that. As far as his concern for his children, this is something that's said specifically concerning his sons there in chapter 1 and verse 5. Job would send and sanctify them. Speaking of the sons, says he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. So, why did he do that? What does the text tell us? We don't have to guess. Yeah, lest they had sinned. Right. In that same passage, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And so this tells us a little bit more about his character. His concern for their spiritual welfare. I mean, so much so that he would go to this length. Alright, his possessions. Chad, you say he was pretty well off last week. Yeah. And we'll just kind of go through some of the details here just so that we can, you know, appreciate just how much wealth he had. We learned there in chapter 1 and verse 3 that his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys. It says he had a very large household, and it even says that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. So, extremely wealthy. Now, I grew up on a 40-acre farm. I have a feeling that a 40-acre farm would not hold, you know, that many animals. I think, you know, they'd have been right on top of each other on the farm that I grew up. So he must have had a pretty good bit of land as well to accommodate all of these animals. And so basically what we can conclude from that is he had many animals and many servants to attend to them. I think that's referenced by the large household. He's not just talking about his sons and daughters. He's talking about all the servants that he would need to take care of all of that. In chapter 1 and verse 14, it says, oxen were plowing. That would seem to indicate, perhaps, that he had crops as well. But just, you know, just to, maybe to get as full a picture as we can. All right, so anything else, at least here in these early chapters about Job, character-wise, family-wise, that we've overlooked? We'll, again, get into some other things later. But all right, so let's talk about Satan. What does the word Satan mean? We throw that term out there, but what does it mean? Adversary or opponent. That's what the Hebrew word means. And so when you think of Satan, think of him as your adversary. He is opposed to each one of us. Now, we wouldn't need to know the meaning of the word, right? To know that he is that. Not just from our reading of Job, but certainly reading elsewhere in Scripture, and especially in our knowledge of the New Testament, we know that's the case. You know, I think about it in contrast to the way Jesus is described there in 1 John chapter 2. I believe it's either verse 1 or verse 2. He's described as our advocate. He's our advocate. Okay? Satan is not our advocate. He's just the opposite of that. I mean, he's trying to, you know, be judge, jury, and executioner. I mean, he's trying to do us in. He's trying to destroy us. Chad, you look like you had a comment. Good point.
I don't know how much of an insight that gives us into the heavenly places of Ephesians, but perhaps it's
good. Yeah, good point. And I appreciate you bringing up that other example from Peter. All right, so there in chapter 1 and verse 7, and also in chapter 2 and verse 2, the Lord said to Satan, you've got two different occasions described here where the sons of God appear before God and Satan is there with them, and God asked him the question, from where do you come? And Satan's answer each time was the same. What was it? Yeah, I'm walking to and fro. Yeah, there in chapter 1, 7, also in chapter 2, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. So, what is implied by that answer? Yeah, I mean, seems like he's going far and wide, right? And we might mention 1 Peter 5 and verse 8 in connection with this. He walks about how? Like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. That's what he's doing. That's why he's walking to and fro on the earth. Seek whom he may devour. And in this case, he thinks he's going to be able to devour Job, right? He thinks, okay, take this away from him, he'll curse you to your face. We'll talk some more about that. All right, but let's also make sure we understand some limitations that Satan has. And again, we kind of got into this a little bit last week. We said sometimes if we're not careful, we can almost make him equal with God in terms of his ability and power and so forth. But at least a couple of things we can point out here. Obviously, he possesses intelligence and reasoning. Okay, that's pretty clear from the exchange there with God and what we know elsewhere. But he is certainly not omniscient, which means all-knowing. And he is certainly not omnipotent, that is, all-powerful. And I think the facts of what we read tonight would certainly bear that out. He knew Job, right? He knew about Job, but did he really know Job? We mentioned it just a minute ago. I mean, his estimation of Job is a little bit different than God's, right? And we'll see that in the two waves of suffering that we'll read about here in just a minute. You know, you take these possessions away, he'll curse you to your face. Oh, no, okay, that didn't work. Touch his skin and his bone, and I know now he will curse you to your face. You know, he thought he knew Job, but he really didn't. So there's some limitation there. He brought suffering upon Job, but with limitations imposed by God, right? In these two different waves of suffering that we read about tonight, there were limitations imposed. For example, there in chapter 1 and verse 12, all that he has in your power, all that he has is in your power. I left out a word there. Only do not lay a hand on his person. So there's only so far you can go. In this instance, say. And then chapter 2 and verse 6, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. So, it's not like he just has unlimited power to do however he wishes. Now, as we said last week, I don't want to leave the wrong impression the other direction either, as if he, you know, is not someone to contend with, right? He has many tricks. He certainly has, a degree of power. So we need to be fearful of that. We need to take precautions. We need to guard against temptation. We need to learn as much about these tricks and devices that he uses as we can. But at the same time, we need to realize that to some degree he is under the control of God. All right, so any further comment about either his activity or his limitations, anything we need to add, Dave? No, it's not. That's a good point. I'm old enough to remember the old comedian Flip Wilson, and that was his line that he used to say, "The devil made me do it." You know, that kind of became a popular phrase or slogan there for a while. But certainly, that is proven to be false. All right, so that kind of leads us now into Satan's first challenge. God has said, "Have you considered my servant Job?" He compliments Job so highly, and here's Satan's response to that. He says, "Touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." Now, what did he say prior to that? What did he suggest was the reason Job was serving God in the first place? Oh, yeah, you got him surrounded by all these blessings. You're taking such good care of him. That's what it's come down to, right? Take all that away, he'll curse you to your face. That's exactly right. And so this begins what we might describe as the first wave of sufferings for Job. And what a wave it is, right? I've titled this part of it, "While He Was Still Speaking." And if you read the text carefully, you know why I have that, right? And really what I'm trying to indicate by that, and we'll elaborate on that here in just a moment, but not only do we learn from this that he experienced great sufferings, but he also experienced them in rapid succession. He didn't have really any time to get over what had already happened before the next thing came along, right? And so let's just kind of go through this and break it down a little bit. The first messenger comes, right? And we're just kind of summarizing this, not giving all the details. But he says, "The oxen and donkeys Remember, there were 500 each of these. They've been taken away. It says the Sabaeans have come and raided. They've taken them away and the servants killed. While he was still speaking, another messenger came. The sheep. Remember, we said there were 7,000 of those. And the servants attending them, fire fell from heaven and burned them up. One message right on top of another. While he was still speaking, another comes. The camels. 3,000 of them. They've been taken away and the servants killed. Now, what is the servant saying each time he comes? I alone am left to tell you this news, you know. You think about what would have been going through this one servant's mind in each case, you know, like, how in the world did I escape? While he was still speaking, your children, all 10 of them, a great wind struck the house, fell on them and killed them. And I just read through that list again, very quickly. All of this happens to Job in rapid succession. So, what would you have done? How would you react? We crumble in the face of all of that? And would we renounce God or would we lose our faith in God? Kind of hard to say, isn't it? I mean, that's a whole lot of suffering in a very short period of time. So, let's think about Job's response. Don't forget the details now. We just detailed all the sufferings and how they took place so quickly. Job's response, impressed? Yeah, I sure am. I think we should, would all be. Quick question though, did he mourn? Of course he did. I mean, it doesn't go into great detail. Now, you know, when we get into chapter 3, we'll see this long lamentation that he has. That'll give us a little bit more insight. Yeah, certainly he mourned. There in verse 20 it says, then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head. What would all that be outward signs of? Outward signs of mourning, right? I think it's an outward expression of, you know, what was going on inside of him. But what did he follow that up with? Fell to the ground and worshipped. Okay. It'd be hard to worship after all that, wouldn't it? Sure would. Again, he mourns. Let's don't take away from that at all. But he fell on the ground and worshipped. Verse 21, naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked shall I return. The Lord gave. The Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. It'd be hard to praise His name. It'd be hard to worship Him. It'd be hard to praise His name. All of that. But certainly, we certainly need to be impressed with his. In the aftermath of this, did he say anything wrong? Did he do anything wrong? No. In fact, verse 22 confirms that, right? In all this, remember what the all this is, okay? In all this, he did not sin nor charge God with wrong. So, obviously, we need to be. Yeah, go ahead.
I think this is a good example for us to see that there is a time for everything. That's free. Sometimes you can let a time for one thing overshadow and overpower a time for something else, yeah, rather than giving place for just.
So after this, sons of God come before God again, right? Who are these sons of God, by the way?
Angels.
I think they would just about have to be. I don't think it's talking about humans. We're talking about in the court of heaven here, so to speak. We won't take the time to go there and read it, but I would recommend that you compare this with Job 38 and verse 7, where, you know, it's talking about creation. God is talking about creation. At the time of creation, it talks about how the sons of God rejoiced in all the works of God's hand. Well, you know, now that could have been after Adam and Eve and so forth, but again, I think if you examine the context carefully there, it's talking about heavenly beings, right, rejoicing upon seeing the work of God's hand. So I think it would have to be that. All right, so the sons of God have come before God again. You have the same thing kind of unfold. The Lord says to Satan, "Where did you come from?" Satan gives the same answer that we talked about just a minute ago. And then once again, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Says the same thing about him that he said back in chapter 1, right? There's none like him on the earth. But what else did God go on to say about him in reference to what had just happened? Still holding fast. He's still holding fast. It's like, hey, remember the conversation we had before? Remember what I let you do? He's still holding fast. Yeah. Right. And I'm not even sure it means the same thing there as it does here. I know this is about as obvious as the nose on my face, but I think it's worth mentioning anyway in terms of application. We know what God said to Satan about Job. What would God say to Satan about me? What would He say to Satan about you? In other words, if it starts out, "Have you considered my servant?" and just plug your name in there, what would God go on to say? Now, again, that ought to be obvious to us, but let's make sure we think in those terms. But, yeah. Even when Satan tempted Jesus in the wilderness, the whole turn the stones into bread and cast yourself off the, you know, temple top and all that. What does it tell us after that? Departed for a season, as some translations say, until an opportune time. So just to go along with what Chad said. But again, James answered this just a minute ago, but he says to Satan, he still holds fast his integrity. "Although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason or without cause." Remember that too. Okay? Remember that too when these friends get to talking. Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar. Okay? In their mind, there was a reason. Right? There was a reason. And of course, the reason they're going to give is sin. You've been bad. There has to be wickedness, you know, in your life for all of this to have happened. All right, so this leads us into Satan's second challenge. Touch his bone in his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And so now we have the beginning of this second wave of sufferings for Job. Think you'd be ready for another round after that first one? First one was about as intense as you could possibly imagine, but here comes some more. And we read about that there in chapter 2, verses 7 through 10. So Satan went out in the presence of the Lord and struck Job with boils. How bad case are we talking about? The sole of his foot to the crown of his head, right? And to try to relieve himself to some point, what did he do? He took the potsherd, I think it says. If I understand the word correctly there, it's just like a broken piece of pottery. You know, something with a stiff edge on it, he can just scrape himself with it. And, I mean, that's how bad it was. Yeah, it's hard to know exactly how they compare, but I get, go ahead. And I believe you. I don't know that I've ever had any bulls. I do remember going camping one time and getting a bunch of chiggers. And I'm not even sure why I even brought that up. But I guess Billy was talking about a time of misery, and it just, it provoked that memory in me, So, all right, enough of that. His wife then said what to him? Yeah, curse God and die. Was she aware of the conversation between God and Satan? I mean, she was asking him to do the very thing that Satan said to God that he would do this. So she's kind of really, in some ways, cooperating with him in that, right? So his response to her is, I think I'll do that. What is his response? Yeah, you're talking foolish here. You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity? In all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. And I would suggest, again, we won't necessarily have to go there, but Ecclesiastes 7:14, another good reference as far as adversity and good. It says, God has appointed one as well as the other. God has appointed both good and adversity. Go ahead.
And her advice was not good advice. Wow, doesn't it speak to the severity of Job's condition?
Yeah, yeah. Very good
point.
Right. And I really appreciate you bringing that up as well. I think it'd be a mistake to leave that out. Appreciate both of your points there. Okay. Yeah.
Just like today, a lot of the things that happen, people always attribute to God. Very seldom I hear them attribute bad things to them. Is that just in our human makeup,
Yeah.
Right. We see it here. But it's Satan who has come.
Yeah, and the only thing I would say to that, and I think we do need to be more cautious, even Paul's thorn in the flesh, Paul describes it there in 2 Corinthians 12 as a messenger of Satan. It's a messenger of Satan to buffet me. But at the same time, remember what God said, you incited me against him for no reason. Remember, God still allowed it to happen. Okay, there were some limitations there. And so, there's a lot to consider on both sides of that. And again, kind of a deeper subject, may not be able to wrap all of that up in a nice little bow. But all right, so the three friends arrive. there in chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. So let me just ask a few questions to kind of get to the details of this. First of all, when did they come? According to the text.
When they heard about it.
When they heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Again, Eliphaz, Bildad, and so forth. Why did they come? What purpose did they have in going to him? I'm sorry? Yeah, right. There at the end of verse 11, for they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. Now, as we will see beginning in chapter 4, it's going to end up involving a whole lot more than just mourning with him and comforting him. All right, so what disturbed them when they raised their eyes from afar? Right. Yeah, it says verse 12, they did not recognize him. And when they did not recognize him, I mean, there's this profound reaction, right? They lifted their voices and wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. You know, Lamar said, you know, the response of his wife, you know, indicates even more about the severity of it. I think this gives us some further insight, right? Just their reactions, like, wow. You know, they had heard about his adversity, but they hadn't seen him yet. Man, when they saw him, like unrecognizable, you know. And I'm sure there was some familiarity with Job, obviously, before that, or it wouldn't be worded that way. But, he's in a bad way. All right, so what did they do and not do for 7 days and seven nights? Didn't speak a word, right? Said they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him. And why is that? They saw that his grief was very great. So, right now, I would commend the friends, wouldn't you? I think that's the best thing to do. Sit where he sits. Try to have some understanding of what all the depth of his agony and suffering. And so, so far, we can commend them for that. There'll be plenty else we won't be able to necessarily commend them for. But. All right, anything else there in chapter 2 before we get into this lamentation? Chapter 3. Anything at all? All right, so we've got Job's lament or lamentation here in chapter 3. And certainly this is going to be just kind of a summary of the points that he makes, and certainly feel free to interject anything that might be helpful in this regard. But really, the first part of the chapter pretty much comes down to this: cursed be the night of my conception and the day of my birth. Now he goes on in the next 9 or 10 verses using all kind of different figures to describe it, but that's really the main point in the first part of this. Curse the day. Not just the day that I was born, that I was even conceived. You know, that tells you just how hard all of this really is on him. Then he says, and again, just kind of summarizing the text, why did I not die at birth? You know, okay, I wish I hadn't been born, but now that I have been born, why didn't I just die at birth and be able then to enjoy the quiet of the grave, the princes and kings and counselors of the earth? Couldn't I just be with all those who have passed on, you know, the quiet of the grave, away from all of this suffering? And then he goes on to point out there are no distinctions in the grave. Talks about all are at rest, small and great, servant and master, all at rest. That's where I'd like to be. Now, do we know better than this? Are all at rest? I mean, I guess you could say those bones and eventually those ashes in the grave, yeah, they're at rest. But the person is not, at least in some cases, right? What do we learn there in Revelation 14? about those who would worship the beast. It says they have no rest. No rest they are not. But we'll get into some of that here in just a moment. And then he asks the question, why is light and life given to the bitter of soul? Those whose way is hidden, those who long for death, why do they have the light of life? Especially when you consider how miserable they are, and their way is hidden, and we'll talk some more about that hidden way here in just a moment. And then as he kind of comes to the end of it, he said, what I feared most has come upon me. Now again, that's just a brief summary of what happens, but anyway, I think that at least kind of gets some of the main points. So, some questions about this lament. And I want to just put these up here. I don't necessarily want any kind of answer from these, because we're going to follow this up with some considerations that might help us better answer these questions. And so we'll just look at them, kind of chew on them a little bit, and then we'll move forward. Does this long lament seem inconsistent with the attitude shown previously by Job? I know for me, I'm like, one minute I'm tempted to say yes. Oh, well, no. But again, we'll talk some more about that in just a minute. Just how critical should we be of his anguish and despair? And should Job have not shown more trust in God, that God would work all this out for his good? Should he have not done that? Just some things to ponder as you think about the depth of despair that he expresses here. So, kind of with those questions, at least in the back of our mind, let's consider a few things at least. Nowhere in any of this does Job say he will have nothing more to do with God. That has to be considered, right? And that's going to be kind of a consistent refrain throughout the book, right? Even though he says some things more than what he should have said, and even though he complains at times and questions God and so forth, at no time does he ever say that he doesn't want anything to do with him. He continues to hold fast. Does the anguish have more to do with the intensity of his suffering, or that he feels forsaken by God? I don't know that we can give a definitive answer at this point. I think later on it will become clear that the fact that God has made him his enemy, at least in the way he views it, really gets to the root of his grief more than anything else. But look in chapter 3 and verse 23. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? Now, when you read that, you might think of that early exchange between God and Satan about the hedge. I don't think it means the same thing here. I don't think it means the same thing. In fact, compare it with chapter 19 and verse 8. He has fenced up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness in my path. I think that's the meaning here. Now, God has, fenced me in. He's put me in a place of darkness. And so, again, I don't know how much to attribute it to. Okay, my children are gone. All my possessions are gone. My wife has asked me to curse God and die. I don't want to minimize any of that. Okay? But we can at least say that adding to that is, it feels like God has fenced him in this way. We need to make sure we remember that Job knows nothing of the conversations between God and Satan. Now, that would change his perspective entirely, right? I'm not saying the suffering would all be abated, but that would change. But he doesn't know anything about that. And it's kind of, when we read through here and we read about all this, if we're not careful, we think, okay, well, maybe Job's aware of, no, he's not aware of any of that. Would it have made a difference if Job knew what we do? that is from the New Testament, what it teaches us about suffering and the hope which sustains us through suffering, would that have made a difference? I would have to think it would. We need to understand, we have a whole lot more light on this subject today than Job did. Now, when we get further into the book, we're going to see Job contemplating eternity. It's not like there was no conception of eternity at all in his mind. I don't want to give that impression. But he didn't know all that we do concerning it. So I think it affords us the opportunity to even have a better perspective on things because of that additional revelation. For example, this passage right here. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. And of course, a lot of other equally comforting passages besides that one. All right, that's all I've got. Does anybody have anything they want to add? We've got another maybe minute and a half or so. Chad? Very good. Well said. And I think about the promise made in Hebrews 13:5 to His children who are faithfully following Him. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Now, it may be, and I know some of you already have, gone through a terrible time of suffering. And the question might be asked, well, where was God when I was going through all this suffering? The same place He was when you weren't. He was right there beside you the whole time. Okay. And I know that doesn't necessarily answer all of our questions, but I would hope that it would still bring us great comfort. Okay. Thank you for your help.